And in the revised version, edited by two giants, Frederick C. Grant and H.H. Rowley, under the section on miracles, this is the paragraph I found. Faith does not turn its back on reason, but it goes beyond. It has more of the nature of intuition. Even the rational disciplines of history, science, and philosophy are based on postulates that are not discovered by reason, but are the intuitions of faith. Once faith is achieved, one is immediately able to understand many statements in the Bible about God's acts in nature, history, and human personality. Unless one believes in God, he will see no miracles. Once he has achieved faith in God, the problem of miracles vanishes. That's an interesting paragraph with which to begin, isn't it? The scene in the book of Acts opens in an interrogation room. The mood is ugly, and the die are cast against those who are being accused. The room is really a trap. It's set in the holy city, foreign territory to them, and in the temple, a place which they rarely went, and in the study rooms and private apartments of the high priest. Two fishermen from the countryside are standing there surrounded by the power of organized religion, and they're there for a meeting so that organized religion can assure the essential power of the state. It is the state that blesses. It is not willy-nilly fisher folk walking along the city street. The issue at stake is a supposed miracle. A sick, broken beggar, one who was either despised or pitied year after year and dragged every day to the edge of a pool at the outside of the temple, is suddenly met by these two fishermen, and he asks them for money. And they say, "We don't have any money, but what we have we'll give you. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up on your feet." And the story says he did. And they found him singing and dancing and strong and full of faith in a living God. And the priestly overlords on that occasion said, "We can't have this. We decide who is blessed and who is cursed. It is clear to us in law and in custom, nobody goes outside the lines. It flows from the central cultic power through the hands of the priests to whoever we choose to bless." Healing and blessing, you see, are tools for power in the culture. They are not in the public domain. And yet these unsophisticated bumpkins from the country maintain that in the crowd, among the great unwashed, the miracle has occurred. A broken life has been made whole right in front of witnesses. "And they didn't even do it," they said. "It isn't us that did it," they said. "We were seeing a direct sign from the living God given in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, a focused sign of blessing in the name of one person in the midst." Worse, they say, that the rest of us are so out of step, we don't even expect things like that to happen. We are the ones who condemn and kill the ones who bring the miracles, they said. Not good conversation to have with a group of high priests and their entourage. After asking that the murderer be released, they added, "You released a murderer in his stead. Is that not the opposite of grace and truth in life?" they said. "We killed the instruments of God's grace," they said. Well, the priests consorted with each other for a few moments, put their heads together, and then they said, "Shut it down. Don't talk about this anymore. Make up something if you have to. We'll be watching you. Make it up. Tell them it was hysteria or fake news or wishful thinking. Put the genie back into the bottle," they said. "That is the directive." But you see, miracle is miracle. It will come when it chooses, and it will bless whomever it will. And our ability to resist it and to control it does not exist. I listened to a radio interview the other day on the CBC with Malaya Yousafzai, the young girl from Pakistan who is fighting for education for girls and women. You know her. And she was being interviewed by another young hero, a young girl who opened a small school in her home in Afghanistan in a village ruled by the Taliban. And the two young women were talking about what that experience was really like. And Malaya Yousafzai said, the message was clear. Don't be a girl, and don't be intelligent, and don't be a dreamer or a doer, and submit to the whims and will and customs and culture of men. Do it every day. And every day, the other girl from Afghanistan said, our young students came to us across troubled streets every morning fearing abduction or sexual assault or being whipped up into a child marriage or genital mutilation or beatings at home or having acid thrown in your face by somebody riding by on a motor scooter every day in the village. And yet, 7 or 8 girls and their mothers came to our home to learn. And then Malala was shot in the head, as you know. She lived. It's a miracle. She regained her memory and her ability and her passion. It's a miracle. The world saw the greatness of this young girl and recognized the power of her cause. A miracle. She is now studying at Oxford University. She is an honorary citizen of Canada, and she won the Nobel Prize for Peace in the world. A miracle will come when it comes and will choose whoever it chooses. Now, we may have found ourselves in an interrogation room now and then because of our views on things, the way we see the world. Leaders and crowded systems don't want us to speak our truths. Indeed, they will try to suppress them. To say out loud what others cannot yet see risks us getting killed. And it's hard to be in an interrogation room. The questions are always nasty and difficult. But when we are conduits of miracles, the interrogation room is but one step in a great screen, one step on a great road, and we're able to pass through it to do that which we were called to do. Well, what is a miracle? I went back to the dictionary, and the definition was any event recorded as an act of God, the revelation of the divine presence to a believer. I thought I recognized that. I am one of the ministers of this church because of a miracle. I would never have expected to be here in a million years. Never even thought that this would ever happen to me in my life. But looking back over a series of starts and stops, over a series of meeting the right people at the right time, over a series of thoughts and engagements and one hand reaching for another, down the river of time, this miracle has opened, and I have the great privilege of spending so much time, so many years of ministry in the richness of this place. This place and our experience together is a miracle for me, an event recorded as an act of God, a revelation of divine presence to a believer. I am a believer in this. There is a variety of words that are translated as miracle in English, many Hebrew words in the Old Testament, Greek words in the New Testament, but they come down to 3 things in English: wonder, sign, and mighty work. A wonder, a sign, or a mighty work. It is something that reveals the unseen thing and leaves you in awe. That's a miracle. It doesn't violate the natural order because the sacred fills and overflows the natural order. We never know fully what the natural order fully is. We know there is something moving in the midst of it. It is not an external event alone, but it's always accompanied by a perception inside so that we see a thing and then we are aware of what we are seeing, and that makes the miracle. A moment comes, a door opens, you step through, and your whole world has changed. We know what that's like in our lives. All of us can speak of miracle by that definition. René Descartes, the French philosopher, said, the Lord has performed 3 miracles, the universe out of nothing, free will, and the incarnation. An interesting place to start. Well, I found this little snippet of a story to turn the meaning of miracle just half a turn. You have to leap a little bit to see it, but I think it's there. Listen. A little hawk leaned sideways and tilted, rode the wind. Its eyes at this distance looked like green glass. Its feet were the color of butter. Speed obviously was joy, but then so was the sudden, slow circle it carved into the slightly silvery air, and a squaring its shoulders, and the pulling into itself the long, sharp-edged wings, and the fall into the grass where it tussled a moment like a bundle of brown leaves, and then again lifted itself into the air, that butter color clenched in order to hold a small, still body. And it flew off as my mind sang out, "Oh, all that loose blue ring of sky, where does it go and why?" I heard miracle in that illustration. We are the gathered body, the hawk is the miracle, and when we pay attention, we are lifted up and carried into the blue ring of the sky. Well, the first letter of John is absolutely dripping with the love of God. On every page, the love of God is the theme. Love is everywhere. Whatever God is doing with us and in us results in more love. And whatever we do in our best moments for one another results in more love. Love is in us. It is the magic wand of miracles. How could mere tender feelings, tenderly expressed in a busy world like this, turn out to be miracles? How could the gentle love we have for our children and their open response of love to us turn people into such magical folk, strong and able and mature, balanced and willing to take their place in the world just through almost invisible feelings of love that are passed from one life to another? Is this not a miracle? The writer of 1 John writes, "My children, our love is not just words or mere talk, but something real and active. Only by this can we be certain that we are children of the truth." A few weeks ago, there was a catastrophe in Canada. We all know about it. We've all leaned into it. The Humboldt Broncos in Saskatchewan were killed, 17 of them or more, many severely injured, as their hockey tour bus was hit by a transport truck on a highway somewhere in the country. It was a slaughter. Expectation turned to sudden death in a brief moment, and the news began to spread, and we began to lay over this terrible news our own thoughts and feelings about our own little junior hockey players and our own times at the rink and our own family times and our own desire of shooting a puck on the street or a ball on the street or going out on a dark night and thinking about watching our children grow and learning leadership and being proud of them as they sprint and skate. And slowly a fabric of concern began to build up, not only across the Canada, but around the world. Two women in the town of Humboldt decided they had to do something. So they wanted to put together a GoFundMe page on the internet just to raise enough money to buy coffee and donuts for anyone who was standing the watch at the hospital as these young people suffered and died. Well, $17 million later, 120,000 donors from over 65 countries have given a message. Love is real and it changes the world. We reach out in love in the face of death, and we pray for miracles out of the wreckage, and by God's grace, the miracles come. Are you in line for a miracle? Are you changing love from a noun to a verb? Is love working through you with a powerful message and a powerful way? I was in the midst of a miracle once, and once you have one, strange as it seems, you never forget, and it changes your perception of the world. I'd spent 6 weeks on the island of Iona back in 2008 during a sabbatical leave, and I had an airline ticket to fly back to Canada. And so on the last day, I took the ferry to Oban and took the train to Glasgow and had a lovely night in Glasgow and a nice leisurely breakfast and took a taxi all the way out to the airport, gave myself 2.5 hours before the flight. And I got there and I walked up to the British Airways flight desk and I put my ticket in the machine and nothing happened. So I went to a British Airways agent and I said, there's something wrong with the ticket. And she looked at it and she said, come with me to the desk. Didn't you get the message? I said, no. She said, well, we changed your flight time. Your flight left 45 minutes ago for London. I said, oh, dear, what am I going to do? She said, well, you'll probably have to buy a new ticket and start over. Let's see what we can do. Go and talk to the woman along the hall. So I went to the woman along the hall. She said, well, we'll put you on the 11:15 flight, but your flight from Heathrow Airport leaves at 12:30, and you probably won't make it because you have to change terminals there, and it's a big airport, but we'll see what we can do. Your luggage definitely wouldn't make it anyway. So suddenly the trip is over, and I'm pacing up and down in the Glasgow airport, and there were three British Airways women working at a desk, and I walked up to them, and I said, I'm not talking to you. I just need to talk out loud. Don't listen. And then I poured out my tale of woe, and I said, thank you, I feel a lot better now. And I walked away, and then I came back about 20 minutes later, and I said, if I needed pre-boarding and needed help to get on the plane a little earlier, would that help at all? They said, no. I said, thank you very much. And then I came back about 20 minutes later, and I said, excuse me, if I were a member of the royal family, would that make any difference at all? They said, why don't you just go away? So I went away, and about an hour later, one of the women came and said, Mr. Sinclair, the flight has arrived, and I'm going to go and speak to the captain. And she came back and says, Mr. Sinclair, we're going to leave the gate 20 minutes early and cut 40 minutes off the flight to Heathrow. We've got you sitting in seat 1A, and there's a steward who's going to hold your hand the whole way. And when we get there, there's going to be a transfer desk, and they know you're coming, and they'll make sure you get over to the next transfer. This is Scotland, she said. What they do with you in England's up to them, but in Scotland we look after our own, she said. So sure enough, the plane took off 20 minutes early. I sat in the front row with a very pleasant man holding my hand all the way, and when we landed in Heathrow, the pilot opened the door, said, Mr. Sinclair, the man you're looking for is right there. And a man down the hall waved at me. There was no one in the hall checking us through. And I ran, and there was a train sitting with its doors open. I was the only one in the car, and it got me to the other platform. And I was doing up my shoes when they called the flight. And I got on the plane, and I said to the man next to me, something very interesting just happened to me. He says, oh, happens all the time. Well, not in my experience, it doesn't. So I got to Toronto, and I went immediately, as I was instructed, to the place where the luggage arrives, and asked to look for the list. They said, if your name's not on the list, your luggage didn't make it. And as I was on my way to see the list, down the little channel came my suitcase, trundle, trundle, trundle. I wrote to British Airways. I said, you are the world's greatest airline. And they wrote back to me, said, Mr. Sinclair, we tried to do that for all our customers. Wow! A miracle. I'm not so half worried about traveling now. Even driving home from the church in the evenings, I feel a lot better about it on our busy Toronto roads. Well, we began in an interrogation room in the book of Acts, and we end up in a circle of collective misunderstanding in John's gospel. Don't worry about it. That's just the way John writes. John tells a story, and the disciples don't get it. And then Jesus retells the story, and then they end up with a pithy little one-liner at the end. And if you read John's gospel, you'll see this pattern again and again. The water into wine, for example, is a miracle of Christ's presence in the world, turning the water of formality and sacred preparation into the unforgettable taste of a wedding feast. In the parable, the leaders miss it, the guests experience it, the servants know the secret. And the line at the bottom, most people serve the good wine first. Then when everybody's a little tipsy, they bring out the bad stuff. But you have saved the best wine for last. There's the message of the church. In Jesus Christ, God has saved the best wine for last. That's how John writes. So in this story, Jesus has just told a parable to his disciples and they miss it. So he goes over it again for them in John's style. Life is like a game board, he said. We move around from square to square. On the way, we meet thieves who steal, and brigands who violate, and gatekeepers who keep the watch, and neighbors who give us joy or pain. That's the way we go. And at the heart of the game is a shepherd, whom we deeply know and deeply trust, an unshakable center, a compassion that will always lead us to green pastures and still waters. That's the nature of life, says the story. Do you have a friend like that, a shepherd like that? After the terrible, terrible storm last week and the snow and the sleet and so on, my wife, having good ideas, said we're getting up at 6:30 Monday morning and driving to the cottage. So in the snow and sleet, we drove 2.5 hours down the road and drove through a foot of slush to get to our place. And there was our neighbor, Michael, who'd come with his ATV and was already stoking up the fireplace and stacking up the wood. And I got thinking about Michael, wonderful, wonderful Michael. A couple of years ago, I said, our cottage needs staining so badly. So we made a deal, and he said, I'll stain it for you. He didn't just stain it. He took it right down to bare wood, started from scratch, and put 2 coats of the best stain on the thing. It looks like $1 million. And he fixed the road. The road is full of potholes. It's a private road. He said, I'll fix that for you. And the next time we went down there, the road was smooth and clear. He plowed the road all winter. His wife brings us cakes and cookies. They have said to us, we will do whatever you need so that you can stay here and enjoy this place for as long as you like. Is that not a good shepherd? We call him the sheriff of Hickory Lane. If we roll in the evening and it's dark and we drive by his place, he'll be out the door in 30 seconds with a bright flashlight saying, who's there? It's great to have the shepherd of Hickory Lane. Sometimes, late at night, he will howl at the moon. Well, we live at the end of a long road. No one else is there. Who cares? And when I hear him howling, I go out onto the deck and I howl back. And we howl at each other. And I know my shepherd's voice. And he knows my needs. We have a shepherd at the center of things. Here's a phrase that wraps up the story for us. You have a good shepherd. This is your miracle. Your gift of love that is a verb. This shepherd has been yours since the beginning of time. The shepherd speaks into your life and you know the voice. You dare go in and out and find pasture. Now we can live with this shepherd, defending ourselves in interrogation rooms if we find ourselves there. And we can risk changing love from a noun to a verb if we dare on the street. And we may face a thief and a brigand, but we also have a good shepherd that is laying his life down for us time and time again. We are so fortunate to be children of faith. No greater miracle could be ours than this.